Welcome to the Beyond the Standard Model course. BSL,
for sure.
What is Beyond the Standard Model? I hope you have some courses on Standard Model. So this is beyond that, obviously. But Beyond the Standard Model is the thing to be doing. If you're doing particle physics. Why? Because this is the time to be doing Beyond the Standard Model. And I can say this year, and I couldn't say that 5 years ago, for the mere reason that this year, and thanks to the Large Hadron Collider, the LHC, we are getting a lot of information, the Large Hadron Collider, a lot of information about Beyond the Standard Model. What was the purpose of the Large Hadron Collider? Well, if you look at the webpage of CERN, what you will see is that they say, okay, the Large Hadron Collider is being built to discover the Higgs. And what they mean by that is that they are trying to discover where is the origin of mass. So what you are going to learn in this course is that discovering the Higgs or not discovering the Higgs is going to be the first step to understand a lot of new principles. In particular, discovering the Higgs will be understanding a new principle in particle physics, a spontaneous symmetry breaking. This is something I hope you've seen in a standard model, in QCD. But in any case, I'm going to explain to you what is spontaneous symmetry breaking. OK, so this is really the time to be doing particle physics. And if you're doing particle physics, the time to do BSL. Something I should tell you is that you should ask me as many questions as possible. Otherwise, I'm going to go woof, super fast, and that's not good, all right? So if you don't understand anything, something, or you would like something to be repeated, ask me a question. Raise your hand, ask a question. Okay. So the first part of the course is going to be dealing with how do we know that there is Beyond the Standard Model. The reason is that we have discovered that there is Beyond the Standard Model. There are two sources of Beyond the Standard Model evidence, if you want. It's experimental evidence. Among this experimental evidence, there is neutrino masses, something that requires Beyond the Standard Model. There is also the issue of dark matter. And another experimental evidence that there should be something beyond our understanding of particle physics is the fact that the universe is made up of matter mostly. Although the laws of physics do not care about matter or antimatter, to the most part, still, the universe is highly asymmetric. What we are made of, electrons, protons, is matter, whereas antiprotons or positrons are very rare in the universe. This problem, the asymmetry between matter and antimatter, is also called baryogenesis. So we are going to discuss in this lecture the experimental evidence for Beyond the Standard Model, neutrino masses, dark matter, and baryogenesis. But OK, imagine that we didn't know anything about neutrino masses. We hadn't seen neutrino oscillations yet. Or imagine that we were not able to measure the amount of dark matter in the universe, Or we wanted to forget about variogenesis. Imagine that we just don't care about the experimental evidence. There will be still a lot of evidence for beyond the standard model. That's what I call rational for beyond the standard model. So tomorrow's lecture is going to discuss the rationale for BSM, the reasons why, even if there were no experimental evidence for BSM, the reasons why we believe that the standard model is not the last answer to all our problems. OK, so let's start with the evidence, experimental evidence for beyond the standard model. It's my first time. Okay. So we are going to start with dark matter, because it's a very neat example. Okay. So what do we know about dark matter? Many things. I'm sure you know a lot of them too. But usually what you write down to show that there is dark matter in the universe is the usual pie chart of energy matter content of the universe. And then you do something like this. You say, OK, the things I know and I understand, the standard model particles are about 4% of the universe. Then about 23% of the universe is made up of some form of matter, and we call it dark matter. And then the rest of the universe is something that is accelerating it. It's the biggest, is the dominating content of the universe right now. And we don't know what it is, but we call it dark energy. So it's about 73 or so. I know it doesn't sum up to 100, but of this order. OK. So this 4% is particles we know and we understand. What we don't understand is why, when we look at this 4%, there are protons, there are electrons, but there seem to be almost no antiprotons and almost no positrons. So that's something we are going to discuss later. So keep that in mind. We say we understand this 4%. We understand the content and the interactions, but we don't understand why all this antimatter disappear. What about dark matter? There is more and more growing evidence that dark matter is some kind of new particle. Either a new particle or a new sector, meaning that it could be that dark matter is not only one particle, but a whole complex sector. But in any case, if it's a particle or a sector of particles, that's something a particle physicist cares about. So we are going to address the question of dark matter from the point of view of beyond the standard model. OK, so what about dark energy? Dark energy is there. We know it's responsible of the accelerated expansion, of the universe. But as to particle physics models for dark energy, there is very little we can say. It seems to be a substance. It behaves in a weird way we don't understand from the particle physics point of view. So for me and for this class, it's going to be a big question mark. So let's talk about dark matter. We know dark matter is about a quarter of the universe. What else do we know about dark matter? Well, there is some evidence that dark matter is not some kind of gravity, some modification of gravity. And what I mean by that is that you could try to explain all the dark matter evidence trying to cook up a model for modified gravity. But this is becoming more and more difficult these days, especially after data coming from, for example, the Ballet cluster. You may have heard about that. And more precise data from WMAP, and so on and so forth. So if their matter is not some modification of gravity, then it's a particle, and then we can start talking. So let's say dark matter, for simplicity, is one particle. But always keep in mind, dark matter could be a complete new sector. Look at this 4% of the universe. That's the standard model. There's a bunch of degrees of freedom in the standard model and interactions. So in this class, we are going to take the attitude that dark matter is just one particle with a set of interactions. But, you know, it is very unlikely. So think on dark matter, and it's going to be probably a new sector. So what do we know about this dark matter particle? We know dark matter is heavy. Why? Because it's been produced in the early universe. Saying that dark matter particle is heavy is equivalent to say that it's cold. And what it means is that this particle nowadays is non-relativistic. So how do we know that this particle is heavy? Experimentally, is first of all, it weighs, right? 23% of the universe, but it could be very light and it just have a lot of kinetic energy. But if you look at how galaxies or clusters are formed and you model that, this is obviously a complicated numerical problem. But if you start modeling this, you realize that things that are not cold, for example, you could imagine neutrinos being a dark matter particle. But these guys are far too light. And at the time galaxies and clusters are formed, these guys are too relativistic. And what is the problem with that? Well, if they are too relativistic, they move along a lot, and they don't allow cluster formation. So from simulations, numerical simulations of cluster formation, there is a lot of evidence that the dark matter particle is what we call cold dark matter, as opposed to warm dark matter as neutrinos. And cold dark matter means that these guys are non-relativistic nowadays. So they have a heavy mass. What else do we know about dark matter? So it's heavy. Why do we call it dark? It's because we don't see it with our CCDs. It's neutral, electrically neutral. That's why we call it dark. And what else do we know? Well, if we look nowadays at our universe is quite old, and there is a lot of dark matter still there. It's a heavy particle. In principle, it could have decayed to a bunch of standard model particles that are lighter. But it's still there. So it must be, at least to some extent, stable. And here, as I said, is to some extent. It could be that dark matter decays, but it does it to a rate that is very short, very long. Or it could be that the decays are, again, mediated into, there could be dynamical mechanisms to keep the dark matter from decaying too much. But usually, the simplest models of dark matter assume stability. So when you write down models of beyond the standard model, it's pretty simple to obtain heavy particles, neutral. But what is a bit more complicated is to obtain stable particles. Why? Because I can always imagine that my dark matter particle decays into lighter standard model particles. So how do I forbid this kind of decay? So models of dark matter are precisely given a mechanism of stabilization, of forgetting, or forbidding, sorry, this kind of decay. So we are going to discuss what models do to offer a dark matter candidate. And the key ingredient for models is often just to rely on, on some stabilization mechanism. To be concrete, we are going to be talking about supersymmetry. And in supersymmetry, there is a mechanism to stabilize dark matter, and it's called a symmetry. In this case, it's called R symmetry. We are going to be talking about extra dimensions. And in extra dimensions, there is another possibility of stabilizing a dark matter particle, and it's called Kaluza-Klein. So we are going to discuss all these things in the future. Okay, so dark matter is stable, is neutral, and is heavy. Medium, yes. Do we know anything else about dark matter? Well, as you can imagine, once there was this discovery of dark matter, and the possibility that this could be a particle, the particle physicists didn't, you know, sit down and wait. And they started trying to design experiments to directly observe this dark matter particle or indirectly observe how the dark matter particle interacts with the standard model particles. So there are other sources of dark matter information, and they come from direct and indirect detection. So what is direct detection? Direct detection is, I build a very, very sensitive experiment. For example, underground in a cave, I put a big detector waiting for a dark matter particle to interact with some, for example, nuclei in my detector, and then the dark matter particle goes away, but this nuclei recoils. So often direct detection of dark matter is just seeing some guy inside my detector, some nuclei recoiling, and measuring the energy and distribution of energy of this recoiling. That's what this direct detection is about. It's directly seeing how the dark matter interacts with my experiment. Yes?
So how is that interaction going to happen? I mean, by which kind of forces?
Very good question. So if you just look at this, the evidence for dark matter so far, what you're saying is that dark matter weighs 23% of the universe because it's there gravitationally, right? Weights. But do we know that dark matter interacts with the standard model? No. It could be that dark matter doesn't interact at all with the standard model. And then these experiments will be worthless. It would be a pity. Okay, so that's this direct and indirect detection is based on assuming that dark matter has some kind of interaction or way of talking to the standard model. So that's why, but what we know for sure is that dark matter cannot talk a lot to the standard model. Otherwise, we would have seen it already. So you need a very, very sensitive detector with lots of targets to try to obtain some information about dark matter. So in other words, the cross section of interaction between dark matter and the standard model has to be very, very small. And that's why you need a very good detector. By the way, tomorrow at, I think it's 12:30, there is a seminar about dark matter detection. We are going to be talking about dark matter detection a lot more, but if you are interested, you can go to this seminar. It's given by an experimentalist about dark matter. Okay, so what is indirect detection? With an indirect detection, what we mean is that, okay, so from modeling structure formation, from modeling the way our galaxy has been formed, we know that there must be a high density, relatively high density of dark matter around. We know there's dark matter around in this same room, right? So now imagine that, although it's very rare, sometimes dark matter interacts with the standard model particles, scatters with them, and produces some new standard model particles, some distribution of standard model particles. For example, imagine that they produce more positrons than you would expect, or more protons than you would expect, or something like that. So by looking at the sky and looking at standard model particles and trying to subtract what we understand about sources of positrons, electrons, and so on and so forth, you may come up with some evidence of dark matter. This evidence will be indirect, because it's not like having a nice detector, understanding all the backgrounds, and then you see the recoil of a nuclei. Yes?
So, very naive question.
Yes.
Does dark matter actually clump to make stars, dark stars, and things like
yes.
that?
Yes, and in fact, as I said, this is all numerical work. It's very, it's an in-body simulation. It's pretty complicated, but yeah, the reason why there is clumping is actually because of dark matter. So dark matter clumps, and then standard model particles clump with the dark matter. And in fact, most of the simulations nowadays, they don't even contain baryons. They don't even contain standard model particles. The distributions we see of modeling, they come from dark matter only. Nowadays, they are improving and putting baryons on the simulations. But until recently, there was only dark matter. So the idea is dark matter clumps first, or is that responsible of the clumping? And the standard model particles, the visible matter, just follows. OK. So you may ask, oh, OK, this is more or less the same question, right? I'm asking for dark matter to interact in some way with the standard model. Why do I distinguish between direct and indirect? The reason is that out there in the sky, there are many things, right? That I'm not an astrophysicist, so I don't even know about all of them. But sometimes it is very difficult to claim that you see a source of, let's say, positrons, and to pin it down to dark matter. Because you don't know, maybe it's pulsars, maybe some other astrophysical source. That's why it's called indirect. Whereas direct detection, this is something you will meet on Earth. This is something more or less you understand. Then it's a matter of understanding your backgrounds. But once you do that, it's your experiment. You scale it up, scale it down. You understand the variables there. And that's why if we saw an evidence of dark matter in direct detection, it will be much more convincing than indirect detection. OK. Any questions? So from all these sources, besides knowing how heavy or how much this dark matter content of the universe is, we also gaining information about the mass and couplings. Of the dark matter particle to the standard model. And before I tell you where are these bounds of mass and couplings, I need to explain a little bit about the way we describe the evolution of dark matter in the history of the universe. And I don't know if you have had any course on cosmology, I guess not. A little bit? Okay. But anyway. So when we say 23%, what we say is that WMAP, a satellite with very good measurement devices, says that experimentally we know that this number that I'm going to explain in a second, omega dark matter times h squared, is order 0.11. Okay, so let me explain each of these things. This h is just a constant, and is of order 0.7. What is omega dark matter? This is the density, energy density of dark matter normalized to something called the critical density. Because we know our universe is very close to critical, knowing what is the ratio of the energy density of dark matter to the critical value more or less tells you what is this ratio of 23%. So you put 0.7 here, you will get something of order 23% with this 0.11. Okay, so what is the energy density? The energy density of a particle in an expanding universe is defined as the density of particles in this case, the mass of dark matter particle. And that's it, sorry. So this is the way you define the energy density for a non-relativistic substance, in this case, dark matter, with a mass given by m dark matter. And why is this a little bit tricky? So let me go over there. Because the way we define the number density in an expanding universe is kind of tricky. So what we do is to use this concept of commoving volume. And essentially, what the commoving volume is doing is to account for the expansion of the universe. So let's say that a T1, sometime at some point in the history of the universe, I decide to single out a portion of the universe, some volume. And there are particles doing their stuff, and so on and so forth. OK. So then I wait a little bit of time, T2. And because the universe is expanding, if I really want to define something that is independent or is factoring out the effect of the expansion, I have to account for the fact that the geometry itself of the universe is increasing, or is growing, so that the same ion particle, the same physics, is described by a bigger volume. This is just a very hand-waving explanation. If you do cosmology, you learn the mathematical definition of a commoving volume, but this is more or less the physical intuition. Is you define a volume that factors out the effect of expansion so that you can describe similar physics at a different point in the expansion of the universe. So when I define energy density, I say this is the energy per unit volume, but this volume, and that's the point, is commoving. It's commoving. And the same, when I define number density, is the number of particles per volume. And again, this is commoving volume. Is everybody happy with this? OK. So what we need to do is to take our dark matter particle. The dark matter particle is produced at some point in the early universe. But the effects in direct detection or indirect detection depend on the density of dark matter particles. Yes?
What's H?
H, yes. It's confusing. It's just a silly constant. For historical reasons, they kept this floating number. They knew it was order one, but they needed the cosmologists needed the better measurements to fix it. Nowadays, we know H is order 0.7.
So what it is? What does it show to us?
It tells you nowadays nothing. It tells you nothing absolutely. It's a thing that is measured. It's 0.7, and don't ask me why people keep putting H squared. You could just pass it here and say, what is the density of dark matter? But for historical reasons, they knew it was an order one number, so they factor in this number. Yeah, I always find it confusing. Okay. So we need to understand how, when the dark matter particle is produced at some point in the early universe, what is the density, the local density of dark matter? So we need to compute a number density. And for that, we need to solve the Boltzmann equation. Boltzmann equation is just telling you what is the evolution with time of this number density. And what it does is, okay, the way my number density evolves with time depends on two factors. One of them, the universe is expanding. And that's why there is this, okay. Factor here called the Hubble constant, which is not a constant, Hubble parameter. So obviously what this is saying with this sign is that the number density in a commoving volume decreases because the universe is expanding. So there is another source of getting rid of changing the number of dark matter particles. If the dark matter particles are not just sitting there in a commoving volume, but they also start interacting with other particles, their number can increase or decrease, right? So to account for interactions, what you get is another factor that depends on the cross section of interaction of annihilation, in this case, of dark matter times the velocity. So these two terms are telling you that the evolution of the number density depends on the Hubble parameter and also on the interaction rate. What is this? These annihilation processes are, what they are doing is changing the number density of dark matter particles, moving it away from equilibrium. All right?
Excuse yeah. me. It's cross section times what?
Velocity.
Oh, okay.
And this is thermally averaged. That's what it means. So you have to compute the cross-section interaction of the dark matter particle, multiply by the velocity of the dark matter particle, and then average over a thermal distribution.
So velocity relative to the co-moving frame? Or?
Yes.
Yeah.
But you will see most of the time we don't even care about the expansion of the universe so much. Okay. So let's go a little bit more in detail. Knowing the content of the universe, we know what is the evolution of the Hubble parameter. So if there were no interactions, we knew how to solve this differential equation. We understand how H depends on time, how H depends on temperature, so we can solve this differential equation. But the tricky question is that to obtain the value of dark matter nowadays, we need to understand the annihilation cross-section. So let's start by neglecting the annihilation and see what will be the solution for this differential equation. the thing, every story you tell of the early universe is a story that refers to some temperature, to some time in the history of the universe. So the temperature, in this case, is something that has to be compared with the mass of the dark matter particle. Why? Because when the temperature is much bigger than the mass, we don't care about the mass. The dark matter particle behaves as a relativistic substance. And then the density of energy and the number density of a relativistic species is set by the temperature. In this case, it goes as temperature to the fourth and temperature cubed. So the way energy is stored, or the density of particles of a relativistic species, is just given by the temperature, not the mass, when the temperature is very big. Okay, so now the universe starts expanding even more. It cools down. At some point, if there was no annihilation cross section, then at some point the history of this particle will be, okay, so I was behaving as a relativistic particle. At some point, universe expanded so much, temperature was so low, that what happens, I become a non-relativistic species. And then my energy density is just given by the mass times the number density. And the number density, and this is important, is decaying exponentially. It goes as this Boltzmann factor. So you take some species and you wait for long enough. If this particle is not interacting with anybody, ultimately what is going to happen is that the number density is going to be exponentially decreasing. So the universe keeps expanding. There is nothing preventing this particle from just being diluted away. And the dilution is very strong. It's an exponential. So that was the end of the story for dark matter. Am I done? Yes. Well, just put this guy here. If that was the end of the story, well, there will be no dark matter density in our galaxy as compared with other things. So dark matter is a quarter of the universe. There is a bunch of it. If you just assume that the number density decreased as the mass over the temperature, it will be very hard to explain that a fourth of the universe is this, is dark matter. So there is something interesting going on. So let's plot where is the log of the number density over a parameter called, let's say, x is the mass over the temperature, which is the physically relevant parameter. Okay. So what we were saying is that when the temperature is much bigger than the mass, the number density just depends on the temperature. So the dependence is going to be very mild. It's just logarithmic, something of this kind. And then you say, when the temperature becomes smaller than the mass, then the behavior changes drastically. I go from TQ to an exponential suppression. So it goes from just being a logarithmic dependence to go like this. And obviously, in between, there will be some way of interpolating between these two. So what happens when we include the effect of annihilations? So what happens is that, OK, I have a co-moving volume. que es my dark matter particle, using my cross section annihilation for the dark matter particle, I can compute what is the rate of interactions for dark matter. And what happens is that, okay, so if the universe is expanding slower than the rate of annihilations, then I can look at a volume. This volume, Komovin volume, is expanding slowly, whereas the rate of annihilation is very fast, right? So where I'm going to end up is, if this is bigger than the Hubble parameter at this point, I will have a thermal situation. And what is going to happen is that dark matter particles are created, annihilated, and so on and so forth. But at some point, if I wait for long enough, so when the Komovin volume is growing, the expansion is growing, then when gamma, when the rate of interactions goes below the Hubble parameter, then these dark matter particles find a hard, they do have a hard time finding another particle to interact with. Right? So if the rate of interactions is very slow, and slower than the rate at which the universe is expanding, at which the things are diluted away, then what is going to happen is that in this situation, the dark matter particles cannot find other particles. It's very hard for them to find other particles to interact with. And because it's very hard, they freeze out. The number density of dark matter particles is going to stay constant because they just freeze out. Why? Because at this stage in the history of the universe, the dark matter particle doesn't have a rate big enough of interactions as to find some other particle interact, some other particle interact, so on and so forth. So the number density stays constant. So if there was no interactions, the dark matter particle would just follow what happens with the Komovin volume. But because there are interactions, at some point, the dark matter particle will stop interacting, and then it will freeze out. So if it does it here, well, whatever value of the dark matter density will stay constant. If it does it in a little bit after, there will be less left. And if it does it a little bit after, there will be even less left. Right? So if this particle interacts a lot, there will be less amount of dark matter density at right now. So as sigma increases, as the interaction rate increases, so that the freeze-out density. Any questions? So we need to, yes.
Sorry, it's a bit counterintuitive because I would naively, you know, if the annihilation cross-section is zero,
yes.
Then one would expect it to be to go down like the co-moving volume.
Yes.
The expansion of the universe.
Yes. Exactly. So you will expect no interactions.
Right.
The particle just follows this path. And what happens is when the temperature, the thermal bath around is very low, then this guy doesn't feel this at all. And then the density just decreases exponentially. So what is this annihilation cross-section doing? It's counterintuitive in a way, because what it's doing is preventing the dark matter particle from just diluting away as it wants to do. So you want these other particles around hitting this or interacting with the dark matter particle are preventing the particle from just going to this exponential decay. Now, even when you do that, at some point, this is not going to buy you anymore. And this is the point. When gamma is of order the Hubble parameter, then no matter your interactions are not efficient enough as to prevent the dark matter particle from doing, you know, from just dilating. In this case, what it does is to bring you to a constant density, the free result. Okay. So I said, really to understand this properly, you should go through a whole cosmology course. But at least this this is a baby talking of cosmology. All right, so we are saying that as the annihilation rate reaches the Hubble parameter, then these interactions are no longer efficient. The density of dark matter particles frees up. So we can use this and say, okay, the annihilation rate is going to be the number density multiplied by this sim annihilation velocity. And what we are saying is that we are going to compute the freeze out. When this equates more or less to the Hubble parameter. So what is the number density? Remember that was the omega h squared in this guy multiplied by the critical density divided by the mass of the dark matter particle. And this is equal to h. And we know h very well. So if we have a mass for the dark matter particle of the order of the GeV to TeV scale, you end up with a result, which is, so you put n here, given by these parameters, the annihilation rate, and the Hubble parameter. And that tells you that sigma times v for your dark matter particle. Well, let me write it the other way. The abundance of dark matter particles nowadays is also called relic abundance. And now you understand why we call it relic. Is this is the dark matter that is left after freeze-up. It's a relic of dark matter. And this, when you put plug all the numbers and the mass in this range, you get something of the order of 10 to the minus 27 centimeters cubed per second divided by your annihilation cross-section times V. So when you then take this annihilation cross-section and plug some value of the velocity of order 10 to the minus 3, from simulations, numerical simulations of the formation of our galaxy, you can obtain that the velocity of dark matter near us is very non-relativistic. It's of order 10 to the minus 3. So when you plug this number in, what you obtain is that the annihilation cross-section is very small. It's of order 10 to the minus 7 picobands. Now, I don't know if, like, are you used to natural units? Okay, cool. Have you ever heard about picobands? Amazing. Okay. So this cross section is very small, as far as I can say. So let's talk about direct and indirect detection. So all this explanation was just to say we can explain or we can describe the relic density of dark matter, the thing that WMAP is measuring, as a function of the annihilation cross section of the matter-matter particle. And what is the big idea? The big idea is that in this area, when the temperature is very large, well, I can have interactions like dark matter particles interact with, for example, standard models. And at high temperatures, a process of dark matter to a standard model is as likely as a process of standard model to dark matter.
Question?
Yes.
I didn't really understand what you did there with the n piece out. Equals and then equals
h. Yes. So I'm saying this is the definition of my interaction rate, the number density times this factor here, the thermal average. What I'm saying is that I am going to estimate what is the value of the freeze out density by saying it freezes out around the time where this rate is of order h. So the n I'm going to get here is the freeze out. And before I had said, okay, this density, relic density of dark matter, is given omega h squared is equals n dark matter, rho dark matter, n dark matter divided by the critical density. So I just put that here. And then I'm saying, yes. Okay. I guess that's the worst your confusion. Right?
Yes. So is the capital omega dark matter the energy density today or at the time of the freeze out?
So, okay, good question. So that's the point of this picture, is to say there was a point in the history of the universe where the interactions of the dark matter particle fell out. And then after that, the density of dark matter particles is constant. So the density we measure now is exactly the same density that happened at freeze out.
Why is it not corrected by the vector by which the universe expanded, like 1 over 8?
Yeah, and that was because, precisely, why am I using this Kuhn-Moving volume? It's because I want to factor out this effect. Very good question. So I define my Kuhn-Moving volume in a smart way such that when I compute this relic density at some point, it's the same I'm going to measure right now. So what I was saying is that the way you can think on this picture is when the temperature is very high, the mass of the dark matter particle is irrelevant. So if there is any way in which the dark matter particle goes into standard model particles, it won't matter that the dark matter particle is much heavier because the temperature is so high, everybody has a lot of kinetic energy. So processes creating and annihilating dark matter particles are at equilibrium. And that's why this is more or less constant. And then at some point, the temperature decreases. What is the meaning of that? Well, it means that the particles around, the thermal bath around the dark matter particles is no longer so powerful, so that at some point the dark matter particles, the only thing they can do is to destroy, annihilate into standard model particles. So we go for this situation at T much bigger than the mass, to this situation at T temperature much smaller than the mass. So now the dark matter can only decay into standard model particles. So the dark matter is just going to disappear. And that is exponential suppression. So the news is that in between these two things, in between this behavior and that behavior, these kind of processes are going to stop, they are going to freeze out. So when these processes freeze out, we don't follow any longer this line, we just will maintain a constant density of dark matter particles. And this is this computation here. This is the moment of freeze out. All right. So, why are particle physicists so excited about dark matter? And why are they so excited about dark matter in the light of the Large Hadron Collider? They are so excited for something called the WIMP miracle. I don't like the word miracle, but it's the way it's called. So we are saying that omega h squared, this goes as 1 over sigma b, the annihilation cross section. And what is interesting is that, so imagine that these processes I'm talking about, the dark matter annihilation, the scattering of dark matter particles with standard model particles behaved as a Thompson scattering. This is just an assumption about the kind of structures you will expect, or the dark matter scattering with standard model particles. Then your annihilation cross section times B will give you something of order. So Thompson scattering is saying that your cross section is elastic. So this interaction is elastic. And then this guy goes, I never get this right, the coupling to the fourth divided by the mass of the dark matter particle squared. Yes. So what is this coupling? This is the coupling between dark matter and the standard model. And this is the mass of the dark matter particle. So you take any, you start thinking, okay, so dark matter couples in some way to the standard model. I'm going to make an assumption. I will say that this kind of scattering is elastic. Then your prediction is that the cross section will go as the coupling of the dark matter particle to the standard model, to the fourth, divided by the mass squared. And why do I care about that? Well, because at the end of the day, you plug this thing in and you assume that the dark matter particle is in the GeV TeV range. And the coupling of dark matter to the standard model is order G, the electroweak coupling. Then you get a the right order of magnitude for omega h squared. Yes?
To the four and uncoupling to the square.
So you just, you assume an elastic scattering between, let's say in this case, dark matter particles and some fermions of the standard model. And you compute that as the Thompson scattering, what you did in second year undergrad. And then that goes as the coupling to the four mass square. You can do QED. And you will get exactly the same with here the electromagnetic coupling and the mass of the electron. And I'm saying this because you could think on the dark matter particle having some kind of inelastic scattering, all kinds of very weird types of scattering. But what is the WIMP miracle, the way to state it, is to say, if I assume a simple elastic cross-section with a mass order the electroweak scale and a coupling order the electroweak couplings, I get the right order of magnitude or the dark matter density. So if I assume that the dark matter particle talks to the standard model with a coupling order the standard model couplings, I get the right order of magnitude. That was the WIMP miracle. And why is it exciting, or was exciting, is because that opens the window for new physics at the electroweak scale to explain dark matter too. And that's why the LHC is exciting for dark matter, because it could be that we see, well, we detect dark matter in the Large Hadron Collider. If it's a few hundreds of GeV particles with Kaplan's order electroweak, this is what the LHC is looking for. So we'll find it. So we are going to talk in the future about ways of discovering dark matter at the Large Hadron Collider. Yes?
Well, if dark matter really kind of these WIMPs. So what's the difference between a dark matter particle and a neutrino? A very heavy neutrino?
Yes. Do you know how heavy neutrinos are?
Yeah. No, but this could be a super heavy neutrino.
Yes. So you see, it could be dark matter where you will have a right-handed neutrino, right? A heavy neutrino. It could be. Mm-hmm. You must make this guy stable. And that's the issue.
Right. Okay.
You know, your right-handed neutrino, for example, couples to the left-handed neutrino, it can decay into it, so it will make it difficult. Okay, yes. In mass and coupling, it could be a heavy neutrino. More questions? All right. So let me just tell you where is the status of direct detection. So I'm saying, because of the WIMP miracle, it could be that's a hint or a hope, if you want, that dark matter has something to do with the electroweak scale, with electroweak couplings. That's the job of the Large Hadron Collider. But in the meantime, there's a lot of people working on detecting dark matter in underground experiments. And there are lots of experiments obtaining results or bounds on dark matter interactions. And I'm sure you've seen this before, but the summary of the experimental status of direct detection is the following. Well, first, let me say that this is a very, very active area of research, both experimentally and theoretically in model building. And there are competing experiments trying, you know, to surpass the other experiment and getting better bounds or a discovery. So the results are often plotted in a plane of the mass, what is called the WIMP mass, versus the cross section of the dark matter particle with the nucleon. Why with the nucleon? Because these experiments are based on having a relatively large detector with lots of targets made up of nucleons. So let me just plot. This is 10 to the minus 45. This is in units of centimeter squared. This is 10 to the minus 45. They always do a log scale, which is pretty impressive. They say minus 44. And 43, 42, minus 41. And the mass ranges from, this is in GeVs, ranges for order 10 to 100 to 1,000. So it goes from 10 GeVs more or less to a TeV. So currently, the experiment called Xenon is binding up something of this. It's saying that all this area is ruled out. So having a 100 GeV particle with a cross section of order 10 to the minus 42 is ruled out. That's what Xenon 100, this is called, this experiment from 2011, so it's really very recent data, is saying. But Xenon is gathering more data. There are competitors gathering more and more data. And the expectation is that this curve is going down and down and down. OK, so you look at this and you say, well, so there is no evidence of dark matter in direct detection. At least this is what Xenon is saying. But actually, it's not true, because the situation is messy, but it's in, yes. Boy, I don't remember the convention factor.
Okay.
Okay. So if you just listen to Zenon, it looks like there is absolutely no evidence of dark matter. But as I was saying, the situation is very messy. And remember, a messy situation, this is what we want. Right? Because it means that you guys, you young people that are starting research, can gain something out of a messy situation by explaining what's going on. So what is the mess? The mess is because there is a bunch of other experiments, so called Dhamma, Cogent, and I think it's Crest. Crest is not here. So there will be a seminar tomorrow about Crest, and Crest is also seeing some events. I see not in this place. But some other area. So there are three experiments claiming evidence for dark matter, discovery of dark matter. So if Dhamma, Crest, or Cochin were right, it would mean that dark matter, we know there is dark matter, but we would know that dark matter is a kind of wimp. Indeed, the wimp miracle is true, meaning that this particle is at the electroweak scale, although it's kind of light, and has kind of electroweak couplings. So that would be amazing. So what's going on? Why is Zenon saying they kill all this area? Why there are three experiments claiming in the same area they see some signal? So what's going on is a mess. I don't know the answer to that. Every experiment has different types of backgrounds and technologies. And the situation is unclear. So theorists are trying to come up with models that won't be seen by the way Zenon is measuring things, but will show up in, for example, Dhamma. It's very hard. Experimentalists are fighting with each other, saying, yeah, you didn't take into account this background, blah, blah, blah. The situation is messy. So do you believe or not that it's dark matter? It's not a matter of belief. It's a matter of waiting a little bit more and seeing how the dust settles. But the situation in direct detection for dark matter is very interesting. Why? Because it could be that there is dark matter, it could be that there is no dark matter. We don't know yet. So there's a lot to gain from, you know, understanding this mess. There was a question.
How big are the data bars on this plot?
When they claim, these kind of things are usually 1 or 2 sigma, and that contains the errors. But yeah, the whole discussion is about, oh, your background here, your background there. If you go to the talk tomorrow, you probably hear about all these questions. I'm a theorist, I'm not an experimentalist. And what I know from theory is that it is very hard. I don't know any model that survives trying to explain evidence here and ruling out here. So murky waters are good for young people, I think. It's 1 hour, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe I'll stop here. Tomorrow we'll do neutrino masses and baryogenesis.